program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And our first story today is Sorority Madness. This was written by Caitlin Flanagan. Ole Miss, as is perhaps well known, is in the heartland of beautiful girls. We know this to be true if we are followers, however casually, of something called rush talk, and we know it to be enduringly true because the above sentence was written by Terry Southern in 1963 in Twirling at Old Miss, which was published in Esquire and then included in Tom Wolfe's essential 1973 anthology, The New Journalism. Let it be therefore established that among the various subcultures of the Deep South, even one as cotton candy thick and Jolly Rancher wide as Sorority Rush is worthy of journalistic attention. Rush Talk, which took off 4 years ago and chronicles the adventures of young women rushing the powerhouse sororities of Southern universities, is now in its late Baroque phase. Joan Didion was repeatedly told she arrived just in time when she went to study the San Francisco hippie movement in 1967. The whole fad's dead now. Fini, caput. Those of us who got in at the beginning were observing something being freshly transformed into content, still trailing mists of a previous unobserved state. This was before Sorority Rush was turned into reality television and podcasts and exposés and brand endorsements, and before the introduction of new characters such as Rush mothers and Rush coaches, and before Rush became a launchpad not only to a successful social life, but also to a chance at TikTok stardom and the busy, profitable life of an influencer. Some of the most popular content on Rush Talk is the OOTD, or Outfit of the Day, a term of the young, worn by the PNM, potential new member, a term of the old emanating, one assumes, from the managerial class up there at the organization's national offices and at the almighty National Panhellenic Conference. The commitment to a dominant style by the Southern PNMs is as unvarying as it was in the day of the Imperial Espadrille and the Gold Circle pin, but in its substance, that style has changed completely. Only the mildest trace of Southern prep remains, but the rest replaced by its opposite, pure femininity. The new look is Hilton Head Brunch, Country Club, Tennessee. It's sexy, but in a sense, it's more of a mood than a look. A little pampered, a little willful. The outfits are composed of bright little wisps of clothes worn with sparkly rain showers of delicate jewelry, bangle bracelets clacking together, Kendra Scott jewelry, delicate must-haves with colored stones functioning more as amulet than as embellishment. The look is headbands, blowouts, lots of extensions, and enough bleachy highlights for an advancing army of blondes. We are face-to-face with conventional beauty standards, but we are alone with our phones and can freely think, conventional though they may be, these girls look pretty good. On an OOTD video, the PNM, alone or taking turns in groups of three or four, stands in front of the camera, tapping a finger against every single thing she's wearing and reporting where she bought it. She likes the lacy, girly dresses from Love Shack Fancy, which seems to have a symbiotic relationship with Rush Talk. Over the past 4 years, it has become a major brand. She loves a venerable Alabama vendor called The Pants Store. They started buying pants from me, and they just called it The Pants Store, its founder said, which now includes a Rush shop selling whimsy in the form of pastel rompers and mini dresses with polka dots and ruffles. She likes canvas sneakers, flip-flops, loose shorts with tight belts, and binding white T-shirts. She likes hot orange and royal blue and lilac. Madras deconstructed, an unwitting evocation of decades past. There's a strong preference for cheap fashion from mass retailers, which are named without a trace of shame, or of the bargainer's hunter's savvy. My shoes and earrings are Amazon, she'll say. My belt is Zara. My skirt is Shein. Shein's extremely short beaded miniskirts owned Rush on a national level this year, and you don't want to be 1 second over the age of 22 if you try to wear one. If fast fashion provides an undercoat, the paint itself has many expensive touches. The girls love David Yurman bracelets in the famous cable style, which actually is preppy and starts at $275. In fact, that bracelet is an economic indicator of whether you should be rushing at all. At Alabama, the average new member fee is almost $5,000. Golden Goose sneakers are still, somewhat witlessly, very popular. Do they not know that The Ageist, a magazine dedicated to the interests of any generation above the age of 40, ran an article 3 years ago reporting that Golden Goose sneakers have hit our people? Most of those sneakers start at about $500 and go up steeply. But she'll very often go from the highs of David Yurman to the airless heavens of Chanel, Tiffany, Dior, Gucci. My necklace is Van Cleef, one woman says, tapping what looks to be an Alhambra necklace from Van Cleef and Arpels, which is the kind of thing a rich man gives to his wife when she turns 40, or catches him having an affair, not to his 18-year-old daughter, who's going to run around a college campus with it. This isn't Dubai, it's Tuscaloosa. Destiny Wilson runs a TikTok account and totals up the price of OOTDs, pausing the videos every time the PNM mentions an item to report its retail price. My dress is from Free People, Wilson, $128. My shoes are New Balance, $90. My watch is Omega, $23,900. My bracelet is David Yurman, $495. My necklace is from Tiffany, $1,025. These bracelets are E. Newton, $206. This is David Yurman, $250. And my cute little Rush bag is from Casemate, $100. The grand total for the look, $26,194. Wilson is fastidiously neutral on the question of whether these things are authentic or dupes. But why would the girls be so forthcoming about Amazon and Shein only to lie about Van Cleef and Arpels? Wilson's account has received many ugly messages from people upset about its existence. That she is black and the PNMs are almost entirely white lends some tension to her videos. Last year she made a defiant post. I will no longer be taking down any price breakdown, she said. I'm trying to destigmatize talking about money, talking about prices. Things cost money, you guys. In August, People reported that she earns up to $8,000 a month from her social media and her storefront on Amazon, where she offers low-price alternatives to some of the items featured in the videos. Her account feels like a revolution. It's definitely the best thing on Rush Talk. That she's also an assistant director of a high school marching band in North Texas with an Amazon wish list of things she would like for her students. Glue sticks, hairspray, 21 large white hair bows, makes its own quiet statement. In the category of affordable luxury that PNMs want, one item stands tall. The Casemate Jelly Totes, many of these girls use to carry everything they might need for a day and night of rushing. The oil blotting papers, the extra shoes, the portable fan, portable charger, Listerine strips, mini perfume, touch-up lip color and blush, body spray, deodorant, water bottle, auxiliary backpacks for the iPhone. Don't forget the Band-Aids and, God forbid, the tampons. These translucent carry-alls, about $100 each, come in a range of colors with coordinating gross-grain ribbons. The widest, most luxurious gross-grain ribbons you've ever seen in your life. For tying the bag closed with a big loopy bow. The first time I saw one, I thought I would faint. It was like seeing heaven. Rush moms are apparently fried with anxiety, and I don't blame them. My life has been rich and uncomplicated because I have only sons. But if I did have a daughter and her first college hurdle was going to be, let's cut the shit, a beauty contest, I'd be out of my mind too. Given how freaked out these families are about Rush, I wondered how they stood up to the knives-out stress of college admission itself. But then I discovered that many of these schools aren't very hard to get into. The University of Alabama accepts 75% of its applicants. All you have to do is fill out an application and send in $40 and your transcript. Test scores are optional. No essay, no recommendations, no emergency calls to the marriage counselor. In contrast, the sororities had developed a parallel Dreamtime system of admission. You cannot believe how many things you have to submit to the Alabama Panhellenic Association to Rush. I will only say that it includes $375, something called a social resume, and a digital photograph, preferably a headshot, no selfies. Rush Talk has hours of advice on how to conduct yourself, usually posted by young alumni of the system, one of whom explains, you want your recruiter's first thought to be, oh my gosh, this girl is so sweet. One video says, don't get too hung up on your wardrobe. It's really not that important. What does matter? Accessories. If you have a cool hair clip or piece of jewelry that someone can compliment you on and be like, I love your necklace. That's so pretty. Where did you get it? And you can turn that into an interesting story. I got it off Amazon, and, funny story, I was watching the Yogurt Shop Murders at the same time. The PNM must present herself as an innocent, or at least willing to approximate innocence, in part by avoiding strapless dresses, and in part by never mentioning the four horsemen of recruitment apocalypse, the bees, boys, booze, bucks, and beliefs. Politics, sex, religion, and money are, we are often told, one was never supposed to discuss in polite society during some restrained era of American life. So these girls will be set if they get invited to a Charleston supper club in 1957. It raises a question. What kind of future or past are these young women preparing themselves to enter? Tradwives, I hear you yelp in horror. They're all going to be tradwives. It's true that these sorority girls are more likely to marry and less likely to divorce than the average American woman, but probably no more or less so than the young women who rushed Tent City at Columbia. It's the college degree that is most predictive of these behaviors. Educated and ambitious young conservative and MAGA women, such as many of those who pledge Southern sororities, have every reason to consider a big professional life, a professional class husband, and a nanny as being in their future. Some of the biggest jobs in the Trump administration are held by women, including White House Chief of Staff, U.S. Attorney General, Director of National Intelligence, Secretaries of Homeland Security, Education, Labor, and Agriculture, and administrator of the Small Business Association. Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, went back to work 4 days after giving birth and has said, I would reject that you can't be a good mom and be good at your job. For a Wall Street Journal article called The Conservative Women Who Are Having It All, Pamela Paul interviewed more than a dozen young conservative women, all of whom said that the tradwife lifestyle was never a choice they seriously considered for themselves. Paul writes that they always knew they wanted children and that they also wanted a meaningful career. One of the women she interviewed is Katie Britt, the youngest ever Republican woman elected to the Senate. Britt attended the University of Alabama, where she was president of her sorority and of the student body. As cowed as the Bambi-like PNMs may appear in their original videos, membership itself seems to make showgirls of them all. Have you seen the huge production numbers these places make as recruitment tools? To a pumping beat, an entire sorority appears in front of the house. The front line performs a kind of explosive acrobatic moves we first learned about in Cheer Season 1. While the others commence something like a Las Vegas review from the 1980s, they look strong, sexual, unafraid of underage drinking or boys. They will not be driven out of public life easily, not after learning all those dance numbers, gathering all that bravado, and cultivating the kind of personal style that clearly opens doors these days. The girl who more or less created Rush Talk and became its breakout star is Kaylin Darnell. She entered Rush as a freshman who had pageant experience and brought a lightly professionalized manner to her OOTD, in which she looked very young and very pretty. She eventually consolidated her extremely positive approach to life in the mantra, "I hope you're having a great day, not just a good day." Now she is a senior. That fleeting, fragile state in which college seems at once too small for you and more precious than rubies. She recently posted a video while walking across campus in a halter top. "Y'all, my life is so weird," she said. "It doesn't feel real. Because how do you go from being at probably the best nightclub in Vegas, sitting at the most expensive table, getting everything for free just because of the way that you and your friends look, and dancing with Heidi Klum's daughter and Marshmello," the DJ, not the confectionery, "all at the same time, that night, to me, having an 8-page essay due tonight." There was a time when this kind of exploit would horrify parents, making them fear that their daughter had become cheap, ruined. But today, Secretary of Energy. We have a sense sometimes that America has become so homogenized through consumer culture and generalized depravity that we've lost any sense of regionalism, of ways of speaking and doing things that are more particular to only one part of the country. But Rush in the SEC schools is proof that certain old Southern patterns endure. The system reinforces many long-standing Southern ideas, the importance of social connections over academic excellence, the notion that strong relationships flourish in closed societies, the emphasis on regional belonging over national competition, and above all, the cloistering of young white women. We can hardly leave this subject without noticing that the sororities of Rush Talk are the historically white ones, although when it comes to several of these schools, they might also be called the currently white ones. It's very hard to find a non-white girl in these production numbers and OOTDs. You would think that the University of Alabama in particular would have some anxieties about this fact, considering that just more than 60 years ago it was where George Wallace made his famous stand against integration, blocking the doors of an administration building to prevent two black students from registering for classes and budging from his spot only when forced to by federalized National Guard troops. In 2013, according to the university's student newspaper, a very qualified young black woman rushed these sororities at Alabama and didn't get a single bid. A former director of Greek Life told Time magazine that it wasn't the current sorority students who had kept her out. Rather, it was pressure from alumni. There's definitely some fear, whether real or imagined, that there would be some repercussions if a sorority took on an African-American member. These sororities, like the historically white fraternities, stand on their members' right to freedom of association, which allows them to socialize with whomever they want. The segregationist rationale, freedom of association. But after the story broke in 2013, The university ordered sororities to reopen their bidding, and offers were extended to several black women. The university did not respond to a request to comment, but as of a few years ago, of the 7,481 women in the Alabama Panhellenic Association, just 56 were black. But enough of all that. We are having fun. We are looking at pretty girls dressed up in Love Shack fancy dresses. This is America in 2025, not 1963. Lighten up, reader. The conclusion of Alabama Rush is an event in which all of the PNMs open their bids at the same time, then run to their new chapter house. These buildings are giant wedding cakes, and they are fortresses, and many of them have crystal chandeliers and white sweeping staircases big enough for 100 Scarlett O'Hara's to make 1,000 dramatic entrances. Let us be among them, thundering across campus in our golden goose sneakers, tears of excitement and relief in our eyes. By midnight, we have to come up with the money, but our parents are good for it. The sisters are ready for us. They're clapping us inside. And finally, we can set down our heavy casemate bags in the massive marble foyer, because now it is over, and now we can belong. Today's second story is entitled Stop Lowering the Flag by Justin Murphy. In the pre-dawn hours of July 4th, a small blue house just outside Binghamton, New York, caught fire. James Sittick, chief of the West Colesville Fire Company, was one of the firefighters who responded to the blaze. Shortly after emerging from the building, he went into cardiac arrest. He was pronounced dead at the hospital later that day. The following week, more than 200 people attended Sittick's funeral. New York Governor Kathy Hochul had ordered American flags on government buildings across the state to be lowered to half-staff in his honor. In Binghamton, the lowered flag was a potent sign of a community in mourning. Elsewhere in the state, though, 100 miles to the west or north or east, it would likely have elicited only a shrug. Lowering the flag was once a relatively rare symbol of public mourning and respect. But Sittick's flag lowering was the 21st in the state during the first 7 months of this year, beginning with a month-long commemoration of President Jimmy Carter that started just before the new year, and continuing with respects paid to, among others, four former members of Congress, two New York State police officers, and a highway maintenance supervisor for the State Department of Transportation. In the past 15 years, flags in New York have been lowered more than 250 times, for a total of more than 850 days of public mourning. That equates to roughly one day a week. New York is not unique. States across the country now lower the flag for all manner of tragedies, as well as an array of annual federal observances, some of which, Peace Officers Memorial Day, for instance, many people do not realize exist. A ritual's power does not lie in the ritual itself, but in the meaning the people attach to it, Nancy Burns, a sociologist at Drake University who studies grief, told me. Far from uniting us in the common feeling, the sight of a lowered flag today is more likely to trigger a generalized sense of disquiet. Something bad has happened, just as it always does. Flag lowering has become a largely empty gesture, illegible to the broader public, and ultimately ignored. The first widely recognized report of a flag being lowered to mark a death came in 1612, when a Greenlandic Inuit killed the British explorer James Hall with a spear, apparently in retaliation for his countrymen's kidnapping of several Inuit on an earlier expedition. Hall's ship, the Heart's Ease, sailed back to London with the flag hanging down in token and sign of the death of Mr. Hall, our general, a member of the crew, wrote. The observant was used sparingly in early American history to mark significant deaths. George Washington's in 1799, Andrew Jackson's in 1845, or to express public approbation. Such commemorations were for the most part spontaneous and locally initiated as part of broader demonstrations of public sorrow. It was not until 1954 that some uniformity was introduced to the practice. President Dwight Eisenhower, concerned about haphazard displays, established parameters that remain in effect today. 30 days at half-staff following the death of a president, 10 days for a vice president, Supreme Court Chief Justice, or Speaker of the House of Representatives, and so on. He also gave the president discretion to bestow the honor more generally. President Bill Clinton was the first to accelerate the trend nationally. According to Brandon Rodinghaus, a political scientist at the University of Houston who has studied presidential proclamations, Clinton signed National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day into law, directing that the flag should be lowered each year on Peace Officers Memorial Day, and was generally more liberal in his use of the gesture than his predecessors. President Barack Obama often called upon the symbol to recognize those killed in mass shootings. President Donald Trump, who has ordered the flag to half-staff 7 times during his second term, has also honored victims of mass shootings, including those killed at a school in Minneapolis in August. Governors, though, have contributed the most to the trend over the years. In many states, the laws surrounding flag lowering are vague. In New York, the governor may honor any public servant who, in the opinion of the local agency concerned, contributed to the community. The human impulse to grieve together is irrepressible. We understand that being part of a community means that suffering must be shared. Flag lowering, for the most part, no longer fulfills that purpose. Reducing the frequency of flag lowering could imbue the gesture with meaning once more. We could also embrace other kinds of public mourning, moments of silence at events, impromptu roadside shrines made of candles, photographs, and other personal mementos, and more lasting gestures such as renaming buildings and planting trees. The procession taking James Sitek to his final resting place covered 10 miles, and flags were lowered along the way. But other honors spoke more clearly to his life. The white gloves and dress caps on the scores of first responders who attended the funeral, the gleam of carefully polished fire trucks in the July sun, the keening of bagpipes, and as Sitek's body was carried from the church, the tolling of the fire bell, indicating the end of his decades-long service. That last article was edited due to time constraints, as we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.